Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The Slate Culture Gabfest is brought to you by Harry's, the new shaving company that offers German-engineered blades, well-designed handles, and shipping right to your door. Visit harrys.com for the $15 starter kit and get $5 off when you use the promo code CULTURE. The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Expensive Speech Edition. It's Wednesday, January 14th, 2015. On today's show, Selma is the new film about a crossroads in both the civil rights struggle and the life of Martin Luther King Jr. We discuss its status as a work of cinema, as Oscar bait, and as a historical document, all with Jamel Bowie of Slate. And then the massacre of much of the staff of the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo has been greeted with the slogan, Je suis Charlie, and waves of demonstrations in favor of the basic prerogative of an open society, the right to speak freely, if unpopularly, and without the threat of violence. We discuss the cultural responses to this grotesque attack on free speech. And finally, in the age of Google, what is a dictionary for? We will talk about the fate of Merriam-Webster with Slate's resident word nerd, Stefan Fatsis. Joining me today is Slate's editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And, of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steve. I should warn you guys, I have a hoarse voice today. I have barely any voice at all. So.
We've got Dana Bacall here in the studio.
I wish.
So she's sounding very, very... I feel like you're about to plan a jewel heist or something. You sound like very, very saucy. You don't look like you're about... Not to spoil anything. You look very lovely for a clearly quite sick woman.
Most jewel thieves smell less like Vicks VapoRub than I do right now.
Oh my, maybe the back of Julia's hand will help cure your cold.
Right. I like the idea of you like slinking into a vault, like trying not to spill your chamomile tea. You have there. If I could just get this pendant, I'm sure I'll feel better.
This is the Hollywood pitch to end all Hollywood pitches here.
I would 100% watch this movie.
All right, well, plunging into actual culture. Selma is the new film from director Ava DuVernay. It stars David Oyelowo as Martin Luther King Jr., and it covers a very specific few months in the civil rights leader's life, from his acceptance of the Nobel Peace Prize in December 1964 to his march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama, in demand of the right to vote the following March, early spring. The movie also stars Tom Wilkinson as President Lyndon Baines Johnson and Tim Roth as George Wallace, the racist Alabama governor. We're joined by Jamel Bowie, a staff writer for Slate, to talk about the film. Jamel, welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Wonderful. We'll get to you in 1 second. I wanted to start with Dana. It takes nothing away, I think, from this movie to say that it's Oscar bait, because in addition to that, it's many, many other things. Tell us what you thought of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, in making this movie, Ava DuVernay really had her work cut out for her. You know, this is the first fictional feature film on Martin Luther King or the civil rights movement in the 50 years since these events took place. And so the temptation must have been great to make this, you know, a David Lean style sweeping vision of King's entire career and life. And she, as you say, does just the opposite and really drills down into this one specific strategic moment of the movement. And I think that's what really saves this movie and makes it as compelling as it is, even for someone who knows this story already. I thought it was really beautifully accomplished, with a few reservations that we can get to later. But yeah, I loved Selma. It was on my 10 best list for the year.
Julia, what did you make of this film?
I found myself really moved by it and impressed with it as a piece of historical storytelling and as a piece of direction. I mean, this is a director who, you know, as she said in multiple interviews about the film, has not really attempted anything of this historical scope or kind of technical scope in the past, and it feels really confident and assured. And I'm curious to hear, Dana, your false notes, because there were a few that I heard, but it just it feels very sure of itself, like she's in control of her pitches. And I thought, it's incredible that a movie like this hasn't been made in the last 50 years. And yet the timing of this movie's arrival, given the larger national conversation this year around Black Lives Matter and police brutality and a whole host of other issues, voting rights. I mean, the very law that we see enacted here is one that's come under threat from the Supreme Court in the last couple of years. It just feels pertinent and well told and not heavy handed, despite the possible temptations and risks there, I think.
Another thing worth noting, I think, is that she was not able to get the rights to any of Martin Luther King's actual words or speeches. Those are, you know, privately, the Martin Luther King family can decide who to license them to. And I think Steven Spielberg has actually the rights to a lot of his speeches for a possible project that he may make someday. So Ava DuVernay also had her work cut out for her in that she had to essentially sort of write oratory that sounded King-like but was not actually the familiar words of King, which I think ends up being something in the movie's favor because we don't hit any of those points, you know, that we've seen so many times in so many documentaries that they may have become sort of these marbleized monuments in our mind, you know, the letter from Birmingham Jail or the speech on the March to Washington.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, Jamel, turning to you, first I'd like to know what you thought of it as a film, but then let's get into some of the issues that you've written about for Slate about the film regarding its historical accuracy. First, what'd you think of it as a movie?
You know, as a movie, I'm on the same page as Julia. I was really impressed by the direction. I was really impressed by how DuVernay tackled the crowd scenes, the attack on the bridge, Bloody Sunday, before then the attack against the marchers at night. I thought those were all very kinetic, very exciting. Like DuVernay really could show you both the chaos of what was happening and zero in on particular people and particular moments. And watching, I saw the movie twice, and the second time watching it, my thought was I would love to see her direct a Godzilla movie. I think she could actually be a really great director for that kind of like disaster film, especially since so many modern disaster films actually do a really terrible job of conveying the chaos of a crowd.
Right. Or connecting the human experience of chaos. They basically are good at putting chaos on screen, but then it's so chaotic that you're like, I'm just watching things flash and flare and I don't remember why I'm here or why I care. And the stakes in this, I mean, she's aided by the natural stakes of this movie, which are just so profound. But I think you're so right that the way she shoots the individuals who are involved, their choices where to be in the march and whether to march, and the tension of the moments right before it goes up into violence, it's really moving.
Yeah, I said in my review that she shoots the protest scenes, the moments of chaos and violence erupting in the protest scenes, the way a war scene would be shot. You know, there's some moments where you have that feeling of being on the ground while violence is unfolding around you and you don't know what is going to happen next. That's particularly true in the way she shows the death of Jimmie Lee Jackson, who was this young protester who was killed by police in the kind of aftermath of one of these demonstrations. And what's crazy is that he and his family were actually pursued into a cafe and he was killed in this restaurant. And she shows this moment, and it's just a moment that you really sort of see the police as these terrorists, you know, I mean, just not unlike the Charlie Hebdo massacres, just people who could burst into any private establishment and murder at will. It's quite terrifying.
Well, and the opening of the movie, which in another director's hands could have felt like too much, you know, she opens with the Birmingham church bombing and we see these children descending the staircase of a church, going past stained glass windows, chatting about their friends and their hair and their lives. And you suddenly realize why you're there just before the explosion happens. And you realize you're hearing a speech with Martin Luther King talking about lives lost. And then you're seeing these girls descending this church staircase. And then you know what's about to happen. And the explosion happens. And it's such a shocking, violent way to enter the film, and it does raise the stakes. It does make you think, right, this was terrorism. The language that we use for this sort of attack now is terrorism, and that's what this was. And it helps connect the story of 50-odd years ago to the stories in the news today in a way that draws a connection that I thought was powerful.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so before we go on, let's listen to a clip from the film. This is after the Bloody Sunday violence at the initial march, attempted march from Selma to Montgomery, where King speaks to the press and exhorts people to join them and clergymen to join them in this march and to kind of expand the range of people who are involved in this protest and this civil action.
Dr. King, morning, doctor. Can we get a statement, please?
Morning.
While rageful violence continues toward the unarmed people of Selma, while they are assaulted with tear gas and batons like an enemy in a war, No citizen of this country can call themselves blameless, for we all bear a responsibility for our fellow man. I am appealing to men and women of God and goodwill everywhere, white, black, and otherwise. If you believe all are created equal, come to Selma. Join us. Join our march against injustice and inhumanity. We need you to stand with us.
It is funny hearing that clip, not watching the movie. I'm realizing Ava DuVernay gave a really great interview with Terry Gross where she talked about Oyelowo's performance and how they were really careful not to get into explicit mimicry of the way King spoke in particular, and to kind of develop a speech with its own rhythm and cadences that carried the same authority. And he does a great job, but hearing it without the visual, I'm realizing that his accent sounds actually a little bit like Francis Underwood from House of Cards. Like the exact intonation is strangely similar.
He's about to turn toward the camera with an evil lifted eyebrow.
So that's like, I should take that back for anyone who hasn't seen the movie yet, because the movie's so great, and that's such a silly observation. But he really does, the performance really carries the movie, I think, because he manages to convey just this the weight of the responsibility he's taken on in a manner that feels really lived in.
Yeah, I think what really struck me about Oyelowo's performance is just how little actorly vanity there is in it. I mean, you're playing just such a lionized figure, and there's such an opportunity to kind of, sprinkle fairy dust on your own head, and there's really none of that in his performance at all. He plays him as, you know, and we can get to the ways in which the script does this, but he plays him as a flawed individual, but yet he preserves that kind of authority and nobility that we associate with King.
All right. Well, Jamel, some people have taken issue with the film's historical accuracy. I mean, specifically the depiction of Lyndon Johnson, who in the film is seen as kind of an adversary of King's. He, in the most controversial scene, it appears that he gives J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI director, the green light to dig into King's personal life, specifically his infidelity, which is not historically accurate. You've written about this, so what was your take on this?
Yeah, I mean, my take is that I don't think LBJ's depiction is as historically inaccurate as charged. From my viewing of the movie, he wasn't an opponent in opposition as much as I think he has this line in the movie that he has multiple priorities, he has the war on poverty he wants to pursue. And so while voting rights is something he wants to accomplish, it's not an immediate agenda item. It's a bit further down the list. Depending on how you look at the facts, that is either fair or unfair. The unfair take is that in, I think, December 1964, Johnson had directed an aide to begin drafting a voting rights bill, and then that voting rights bill became the basis for the one that made its way through the Senate. But it should be said that decision to ask someone to draft something wasn't – Johnson didn't have any intention of pushing it for a vote anytime soon. It was just sort of something to have in the pocket. So the film doesn't portray Johnson as opposed to voting rights, just sort of, I have other priorities. And so it's the job of King to make voting rights a priority. I think critics have, you know, much firmer ground when they point to the Hoover scene, which does really carry the implication that Johnson directed Hoover to release the tapes. Johnson certainly knew about what Hoover was collecting, but the idea that he was responsible for sending it out there it's just not the case. Historical inaccuracy is just something that comes with, I think, filmmaking about historical events. I think the bigger question is how much of Selma is true, capital T true, to what we know happened. And I think it's very true to what happened.
And those scenes between Tom Wilkinson as Lynda Baines Johnson and Oyelowo's King, I think, are some of the dramatic high points of the movie. I mean, just some of the negotiations between them about, you know, in what order to take on these priorities that they both share. When you look at where the criticisms of the portrayal of LBJ are coming from, Jamel, it looks like a lot of them are coming from people who work for the LBJ Library and, you know, people who have a lot of interest in defending that vision and that memory of him.
Right. And I think it, you know, it doesn't help that Johnson has had sort of hasn't had the greatest reputation, that Vietnam so has defined his reputation as president that his genuine commitment to civil rights has fallen by the wayside. And, you know, if anything, I kind of think this movie does a decent job of bringing that to the forefront, that showing Johnson was very much concerned about these things. I mean, his scene with Tim Roth as George Wallace, which, as an aside, I really loved Tim Roth as George Wallace.
It was great.
Watch a whole movie of Tim Roth as George Wallace. But that scene where Johnson essentially says, I don't want to be on the wrong side of history, and I don't want to be on the wrong side of history with you, I think is sort of a nice punctuation mark to Johnson's actual substantive commitment to getting civil rights right.
Jamel, you had a great piece about what the Black Lives Matter activists might learn from this film. What were your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, I think it goes back to the depiction of LBJ. I mean, one of the things the movie does really well in showing the back and forth and showing the strategizing is that at every step, King is giving LBJ, he's giving the, you know, Jim Clark, he's giving everyone, all of his opponents or all of the reluctant members of his coalition, a way to say yes to sort of save face. And I think that's something that, in my read of the burgeoning Black Lives Matter movement, I'm not really seeing much of a way to not just appeal to the consciences of sympathetic whites, but also to give both opponents, in this case, opponents be, you know, police departments and sort of reluctant allies or reluctant members of the coalition, a way to say yes in a substantive way to get something that would relieve the pressure. A good example of sort of like the problems with not giving the other side a way to say yes is, I think, was it last week or 2 weeks ago? Time all runs together for me. There was something where people were interrupting brunches by reading off the names of young Black people killed by police. And I kind of get why you would do that, but it strikes me as something that alienates more than it does, like, do anything. And even if it doesn't alienate, I'm not really sure how you're supposed to respond to that if you're someone on the fence. Like, if I were in that situation, I wouldn't know how to respond. And I think insofar that the movement needs, like, a change in strategy or tactics, and I'm not sure that it does, but if it does, it needs to move more towards sort of the strategic use of spectacle and less away from spectacle for the sake of spectacle.
Well, and one thing that's really interesting about this film that I left it thinking about is that, at least as portrayed in the film, King and his crew were strategizing and relying on just the abject viciousness of some of their opponents. And in a world where racism takes much more abstract, systemic, I mean, not always, obviously, as we've seen this year, but has a tendency to be a little bit more deeply buried, it's harder to use that same strategy. But maybe we should circle back around to the movie itself, because we're getting somewhat far afield. I feel like this should win all the Oscars. But Dana, you mentioned your reservations. What are your reservations?
I mean, I would love to see this movie get a bunch of Oscars. I can't imagine anybody's performance surpassing David Oyelowo's, as much as we loved also Timothy Spall and Mr. Turner that we talked about. But I mean, I'm kind of an Oscar agnostic. I think they're both incredible performances and worthy of recognition. I mean, my aesthetic reservations about this film are minor. I think there are small moments where it does slip into a biopic-like familiarity, something that we have seen in a lot in many such historical dramatic reenactments. There's some schematism like that, but so much less than there could be in a movie that has this much history to cover.
Yeah. Also, it made me want to watch like three more little mini chapters. I would like her to make three more movies about King with this cast, highlighting different moments in his life.
Right, because it's not just about King. There's so many characters in it. I mean, Jamel was wishing for a whole movie with Tim Roth as Governor Wallace. I would love a whole movie about Diane Nash, who's a tiny character in this movie, but a really fascinating character in the movement. Maybe she'll get her movie next.
All right, well, Jamel, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about the movie. I hope we have you back on soon.
Oh, not a problem. Happy to chat.
All right. Well, the movie is Selma. It's directed by Ava DuVernay. And let us know what you think of it. Come to Facebook.com/CultureFest. All right. Well, now is the moment in our podcast where we talk about our sponsor. Julia, what do we have?
Our sponsor this week, Steve, is your baby smooth cheeks. We are sponsored once again by Harry's.com, which is the razors by mail service that we've talked about before on the show. And it's a new year. It's January. It's our second podcast of 2015, and it is the time in your life when you look at the broad expanse of 2015 ahead of you and you start thinking, I could live my life better. I could change everything. I could be doing everything so much more smartly and wonderfully. And one thing you can do is stop spending time and money on expensive plastic blades. you could just have your razor show up in the mail and then use its kind and lovely emollients and make your cheeks as lovely as Steve's. Steve, how nice are your cheeks?
My cheeks right now are stubbly, sebaceous mess. But as a treat, I'm going to drag elegantly over the stubbly sebacity, the beautiful Harry razors, and I'm going to emerge a cherub.
Harry's is backing out as a sponsor so fast right now.
I like Steve the cherub. Are you going to purse your lips and blow a little rain cloud around the firmament?
I'm sprouting tiny little wings even as we speak now, Julia.
Fantastic. All right. Well, Harry's has a special deal for our listeners. Their starter kit is just $15, which includes the razor, three blades, and your choice of Harry's shave cream or foaming shave gel. And as an added bonus, you can get $5 off your first purchase with our code CULTURE. And after using the code CULTURE, you can get an entire month's worth of shaving for just $10. So again, that's harrys.com now and $5 off with the code CULTURE. We thank them so much for supporting our show.
All right, thanks, Julia. Moving on, last week in Paris, after forcing their way into the offices of the French satirical weekly Charlie Hebdo, two gunmen massacred 12 people, including the publication's editor, Stéphanie Charbonnier, and seven other Charlie Hebdo employees, as well as two police officers, and wounding 11 others. It was horrifying, of course. The gunmen were apparently trained by a Yemeni branch of Al-Qaeda and were seeking revenge for the magazine's satirical depictions of the Prophet Muhammad. Immediately after the attack, the slogan Je suis Charlie went viral, and there have been huge marches in show of solidarity for both the victims and for the right of free speech within the context of an open society and without the threat of violence. In many ways, Julia, this is a very simple story, a horrible, horrible thing happened. It's inexcusable on every level. And people's support for the Je suis Charlie hashtag and slogan is quite moving. Nonetheless, a number of incredibly complicated issues arise with a situation like this, that it's the privilege of a free society to talk through openly and often in conflict. The first one of which is, would Slate publish these images?
Slate did publish these images the day of the attack. We published a few of the most controversial covers of Charlie Hebdo and had a post translating them and sort of explaining what the jokes had been and what the responses had been, including a couple of the images that showed the Prophet Muhammad, which some had objected to. But, you know, a lot of people did not publish them. A lot of mainstream American publications, newspapers, television networks did not publish them. And most of the folks who did publish them tended to be digital entities. We published them. The Huffington Post published them. The Daily Beast published them. The Washington Post's op-ed pages, but not its news pages, published them. I mean, to my mind, in order to understand this story, you need to understand what this publication was and where it fit into the French publishing landscape, which is, it's always a little bit odd to insert yourself into the alternate reality of the media landscape of another country, because the kind of cultural distinctions and sorts of publications that exist can closely mirror your own, but then also just be skewed through the lens of the different culture. And to understand what this magazine was, what role it played, and what these cartoons were that had caused so much controversy, I thought people needed to see them. But, you know, obviously it's a decision that's easier to make when you run an opinion journal based in New York and D.C. and not an international reporting staff of hundreds all over the globe. But I was still surprised by the variety of responses from the American press. I'm curious what you guys thought. I mean, it's something that to me seemed like a piece of news context, but did you find yourself wanting to see the images, looking for them, trying to find them? Where did you come? In some ways, this domestic American media debate about the cartoons is the least important. Well, I don't know. It seems like it could be one of the less important things about this attack. But on the other hand, if it's an attack on a free society, maybe it is important. Where did you guys come down?
I mean, I know I can say I, for one, am glad that those images were out there, and not only out there, but in many different places, including Slate, you know, well explained and well translated and sort of placed in the context of a very long tradition of anti-clerical kind of ribald humor in France. And some of those images are really, really gross and xenophobic, and it's not something that you sort of want to proudly put your hand over your heart and say Je suis Charlie about. I think there was a certain amount of hypocrisy to the number of people that, you know, stood up in defense of free speech in the wave of the attacks without taking into account in any way sort of the context of these images and what they might mean, which is not obviously in any way, you know, a defense of the attack, but of the maybe sensibility of the many, many nonviolent Muslims in France and all over the world who still might find these images upsetting.
Steve, where did you come down on all of this? Were you digging around trying to understand the publication?
No, and for the same reason that I don't think it was important to consider either the, you know, architectural value of the Twin Towers or the, you know, social value of the activities that were going on within them in order to assess the extent of the crime of 9/11 and what the appropriate reaction to the destruction of the World Trade Center would be. I just don't think it matters. I mean, the one thing we've learned since these attacks is that French people have mixed feelings, to put it mildly, about this publication, and that they had those feelings prior to the attack and prior to the previous attack on them and threats to them. Some people felt that the publication was more than just anti-clerical. It was, you know, anti-Semitic in some instances. I have no way to evaluate these claims whatsoever. And the truth is they don't matter. It wouldn't matter if they were the KKK. It wouldn't matter really what they were. I mean, Europe has a very different notion of, or at least a somewhat importantly different notion of free speech and hate speech. And they do circumscribe certain kinds of different European countries circumscribe hate speech differently. But nonetheless, you know, the principle is essentially the same, right? Which is that regardless of how offensive it was, the right to say it was more or less absolute. And that right was abridged by a bottomless act of thuggery. All of the interesting issues to me have nothing to do with the depiction of Muhammad, nothing specific to do with these specific depictions of the Pope or Muhammad or whomever, and everything to do with the complicated reaction to terroristic acts on the part of a pluralistic society. So, for example, to the degree that we're celebrating the ability to have profound intellectual differences with one another, how do we feel about highly unified expressions of solidarity in the wake of an attack like this? I think a part of us should sway emotionally along with them, absolutely, and a part of us should stay reserved and acknowledge also that in our recent history, such displays of unity have been very quickly appropriated to political forces that are actually anti-pluralistic. And so, to my mind, it opens a Pandora's box that should be open on a more or less permanent basis. I mean, it's the, in some ways, quite horribly taxing demand of a pluralistic society to live with ambiguity about social ends and social means. And I worry when an especially graphic, I mean, in relation to our discussion about Martin Luther King, this is very apposite, because it was how graphic those images were and the fact that they were televised that really galvanized public opinion in favor of the civil rights movement. And so so of course there are instances where something horrific happening in a mass media context actually does awaken a moral conscience, and the more unanimous, the better. I just think that the lesson of 9/11 can't go unlearned here. And I immediately put Je suis Charlie on my Facebook page, but it only took me about 48 hours to regret it because I'm not sure that I am that. And I'm not sure that proclaiming you're not isn't in some ways the best way to maintain a diversely opinionated society.
Well, right. But in addition to Je suis Charlie, there was Je ne suis pas Charlie. Again, my French is coming out poorly because I don't have any on the show. But, you know, there was the initial step of solidarity, and then there was the comfort of saying, you know, I can abhor this absolutely as an act of gross violence and also say that I didn't like Charlie Hebdo and I thought they were racist, or I thought their cartoons were reprehensible, or I thought they were dumb, or, you know, it's just not my thing. And, you know, the freedom to say that and make that distinction I thought was interesting. You know, what do you guys make of folks who've talked about, I mean, speaking of Boko Haram, the Boko Haram massacre that occurred the same week, where I think details are still coming out, but it seems like more than 2,000 people were killed in a horrific act of terrorism and violence, and the media-driven West is extremely focused on the deaths of a handful of white men in France and not so much on the thousands of black people in Nigeria. You know, do you think those critiques have been useful, valuable, misguided? What have you made of that response?
I don't see where that equivalence needs to be brought in at all, because the attacks in France are specifically, they're both you know, the brutal deaths of these specific individuals, but it's also an attack on a principle shared by the West, and that poses on an ongoing basis a set of complicated questions about what counts as speech, what counts as protected speech, how absolutist is our commitment to speech. In the case of France, do we place this in the context of colonialism and the really checkered history of Muslim immigration in France? These are all live and ongoing issues, whereas there's a human rights, which is not to minimize the horrible terroristic act committed by Boko Haram, but it's not clear what moral challenge is posed by an atrocity in that part of the world directly to us. I mean, there's a foreign policy challenge, there's a human rights challenge. Those things are not small, but it does seem to me that there's a direct challenge to the identity and self-image of us as Western societies that needs to be dealt with. I mean, it has to be thought through. What I refuse to do is feel the guilt trip of the person, you know, who's accused of not caring about lives in far-flung parts of the world, because I can do nothing as a citizen of the United States and of some abstraction called the West really to have very much effect on that. But on an ongoing basis, what I can do as a citizen of this country is ask myself to what extent I want to hold my leaders responsible, in what proportion I want to hold them responsible for something called free speech and multiculturalism versus the safety of myself and my family. And then secondly, you know, kind of to examine my own feelings in the wake of horrific events like the attack on Charlie Hebdo, with some memory of how a solidarity that I felt very much a part of after 9/11 was abused in favor of drumming up support for a completely, it seems in retrospect, unnecessary and ill-motivated war. Anyway, it seems to me these are of direct relevance to our own volition as citizens, whereas the other is really just an expression of a kind of generalized horror at how awful the world can be.
Well, I don't know if American citizens have no ability to influence foreign policy further abroad than Paris. But so if you're you know, a domestic American citizen and you're thinking about how you want to pressure your government to balance these things, multiculturalism, free speech, your safety, where does that leave you in terms of the, you know, robust Je suis Charlie response or the decision to print or not print cartoons or any of the rest of it?
I'm agnostic on the image issue. I mean, again, I don't think we needed to hand-wring about, you know, whether or not global free enterprise is an intrinsically valuable thing when the Twin Towers are leveled by a couple of airplanes. You know, I thought they were ugly buildings, and I thought a lot of the activity that went on in them was not, you know, admirable, but it was irrelevant. It was, so on the one hand, the specific content of the images are by and large unimportant to me. I also feel like I'm never going to be able to penetrate the semiotic veil of Frenchness that makes them either offensive or meaningful or acceptable or unacceptable to actual French people. But let me give you another example. One of the very first responses to the attacks was written by George Packer on the New Yorker blog. And he starts a piece on a terrorist attack on the concept of free speech by circumscribing what other people ought to say about the attack. I mean, implying right off the bat that any kind of sociological context, you know, any invocation of French colonialism, it should be basically disallowed on its face. And it seems to me this is where solidarity goes very quickly. It goes from something I think quite earnest and admirable into something manipulable and, in fact, anti-pluralist if we're not careful.
Right, Steve. I mean, the idea of prescribing, for example, any investigation or discussion of France's really terrible policy toward its Muslim immigrant population over the last decades, for example, banning girls from wearing the veil in school, et cetera, that seems like it's all part of this conversation just as much as those images are. I can see how for a nonviolent Muslim in France, how all this would feel right now, and it would suck. You know, if you're like a poor person living in the banlieue or whatever, you know, you lost your job because you're wearing a veil like the Hayat Boumediene girl did. I can completely see how all of these, you know, white Europeans and international community kind of putting their hand over their heart and declaring their allegiance to this magazine that insults your religion could sort of feel like, you know, there's no way out. I mean, it's sort of like it is after the 9/11 attacks, where talking about the kind of discontent that gives rise to this kind of violence for at least a little while was off the table.
Right. On the other hand, I did have a visceral response. I don't know if you guys saw the Joe Sacco cartoon, which pointed out that, of course, cartoonists should be able to draw whatever they want, but it's hard to understand this attack without thinking about all of the various ills that have happened after 9/11, including torture. And he draws, you know, an image basically of some of the Abu Ghraib photographs that emerged. And I found that response I found that response to be totally off base somehow. I mean, not that he didn't have the right to say it. Of course, he had the right to say it. I'm not trying to police anybody's speech here, but torture is not an acceptable response to anything, stipulated. Colonialism is not an acceptable global behavior, stipulated. But also, like, just like gunning down a room full of people is like it does seem like there needs to be able to be a conversation about larger global forces prompted by this. But it also feels. It feels to me problematic to treat an attack like this as in any way a rational act, mm-hmm. you know, and it is tricky. I mean, like, we're so used to filing gunmen under like crazy young men here in the States because the attacks tend to be more personally motivated and not funded or financed or trained by global terrorist bodies. But the shift from I'm going to fly a plane into a building to I'm just going to go into a room with a gun and terrify people or run around a city with a gun and terrify people. That's something that we have experience with here in the States. And tend to file as crazy, and where you align an attack like this with a whole political movement or ideology or mode of terrorism, like, of course, to understand how it happened, you have to understand that. But something about that Joe Sacco cartoon, I don't know, it treats the men who committed this horrific act and shot up that office and murdered those people as like rational political actors in a way that I find disturbing. Mm.
Well, I modestly suggest that we take our befuddlement as a sign of mental health, all evidence to the contrary, because there is no simple or unified response to this. And it shouldn't be implied that there is or should be, right? That in some way a society's tolerance for a wide diversity of opinions is reflected in individuals as well and their ability to hold several contrary things in their minds at once. All right. Well, anyway, we've come to no conclusion. Maybe you can help us come to even less of one. Come to Facebook.com/CultureFest and tell us what you think about the Je suis Charlie movement. All right. Moving on.
Steve, before we move on and talk to Stefan Fatsis about the dictionary, I have an announcement for our listeners, which is that the writers and editors behind Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog, will be convening for an evening of queer conversation about the latest gay news, culture, and controversy, and it's happening Tuesday, February 3rd at City Winery in New York. City Winery being an awesome venue where we've done at least one show, but it's a great room, a really fun space. Slate's Brian Lauder, Mark Stern, and June Thomas will share the stage with actress and singer Leah Delaria, who plays Big Boo on Orange is the New Black and has written for Slate a few times. And at the end of the evening, audience members will have an opportunity to pose their very own Ask a Homo questions. This is the video series that June and Brian have been doing for us for the last year. So again, that's Tuesday, February 3rd at City Winery in New York. For more information, go to slate.com/outwardnyc.
All right, moving on. Stefan Fatsis is the author of Word Freak and a panelist on the excellent Slate sports podcast Hang Up and Listen. As the subhead for his latest article for Slate says, Merriam-Webster is revising its most authoritative tome for the digital age. But in an era of twerking and trolling, what should a dictionary look like? And do we even need one? Stefan, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Great to be with you.
Stefan, your piece begins with a quite remarkable portrait of the Merriam-Webster headquarters. It's a kind of time capsule. It's superannuated, charming, and possibly totally obsolete. It's been more than 200 years since Noah Webster first published a dictionary. This is the last fully staffed American dictionary maker standing, as you say in the piece. But do we still need this at all? What we all grew up with, the single volume compendium of words. Where did you come out on this?
Well, I came out that I think we do need it. And we might not need it in the same way that we needed it when we were growing up. The conventional wisdom of what a dictionary is, or the conventional idea of what a dictionary is, this book that you keep on a desk that you open up periodically when you're confused about something. You know, a dictionary is different now. A dictionary is in our pockets. A dictionary is everywhere. And the contents of a dictionary are everywhere. You type in a bunch of words or a letter string into a search engine, and you can gather more information on your own than a dictionary could provide you in any form or fashion. Having said that, well, the value of the dictionary, I think, stays with us, which is the ability to curate and analyze and explain language. That is the province of lexicographers. These are people that are trained to do that. And there is tremendous value. And Merriam-Webster and other dictionary makers that are still, you know, making dictionaries are basically staking their future on figuring out a way to adapt to the new digital world.
All right. So a dictionary going into the future, if I understand you correctly, is not going to be the book, the physical book that we go to a store and buy and take home and consult as necessary. It's as ambient as the content of a dictionary may be thanks to the internet, it still has to be a building somewhere filled with specialists doing the curatorial work upon the English language in order to do what exactly?
Well, that is under debate. There are sites like WordNik, which is run by a lexicographer named Aaron McKean, who used to work at the Oxford Dictionaries and is very mainstream, schooled in lexicography. And her belief, and the belief of many other people, was that a dictionary doesn't have to be this sort of rigid, formal place with words that are determined by some august group of lexicographers. Maybe not even August, just a bunch of people who get to call themselves lexicographers and say what words get to go in a dictionary. You think about Urban Dictionary, not a great example, but you think about Urban Dictionary or Wiktionary or WordNik, and these are crowdsourced. And there is a huge potential, and it's already happening, that the public can help determine what a word is, when a word is a word, and how a word is defined and used. I mean, it's always been the case. Going back to the first Oxford English Dictionary, James Murray, the first editor, put out a call to the public to help him create this dictionary. And he, all the citations, the little slips of papers with references to words in use in the real world, for the OED, those were contributed almost, you know, I mean, to a great, great extent by people mailing in pieces of paper to James Murray, the Professor and the Madman, the book by Simon Winchester. The Madman was some guy sending in thousands of examples of usage of words. So in a way, lexicography has always been crowdsourced. But now the internet has made it so much easier to crowdsource it. So Merriam and other dictionary companies, Oxford, American Heritage, there are still a few out there. They have to find, you know, what is the sweet spot between, you know, the sort of formalistic dictionary definition between the pages and the sort of chaos of the internet.
I mean, one thing, it strikes me that there's two big changes here, right? One is the decision to take the Merriam-Webster unabridged digital and to not have the constraints of a physical book. And that shift from finite to infinite space, which is one that we've seen paralleled in journalism mm-hmm. as we've moved digitally, allows a ton more freedom, right? Like, it used to mean something to get in a word in the dictionary because they could only fit so many words in the dictionary. And so a word, they had to compare the relative values of words, the relative widespreadness of words, and a word had to gain a certain amount of cultural currency and prevalence to be worthy of inclusion, right?
Absolutely. And that's how Merriam-Webster operated and still operates. They collect citations, examples of usage of words. They used to be crammed into these unbelievable, these amazing filing cabinets at Merriam's headquarters in Springfield, Massachusetts. They have 16 million slips of paper in these cabinets. They stopped printing them out in like 2009. And now it's all electronic. It often took like a decade or more for a word to sort of reach this threshold, this subjective threshold, whereby the editors would say, yes, we give it our approval. It is now worthy of entry into the unabridged dictionary or into a smaller dictionary like Merriam's Collegiate Dictionary. And absent that constraint, yeah, that's what makes this such a compelling question for lexicography. You don't have these constraints anymore, so why are we bothering with the pretense of, does this word rise to a level that we deem it worthy of inclusion in our list? Maybe we should just put it on the list the way WordNik and other places on the internet do and say, hey, some people came up with this word. Here's what it means. Here's a couple of examples of its usage. Merriam's utility is saying, no. Here are multiple examples of usage and usage that indicate that this word deserves to be acknowledged as something that has permanence, that will be with us.
Right. Two examples you cite in your piece are the word upcycle and the word upfake, right? Mm-hmm. And so upcycle is primarily a noun usage, talking about an upward trend in primarily business contexts. I'm not being as precise as the many. You beautifully carry the reader through a couple of the different iterations of this definition. Upfake is one that has many, many fewer examples and refers to someone basically faking a shot in basketball. And maybe there's a case that both were, you know, if they've done the work to record that both words exist, one is much more prevalent, one is sort of a very rare coinage having to do with a basketball move that's more often referred to in other ways. You know, if they've done that work to think that through, maybe they should just include both words, but add the context that upfake had a brief blip of appearing in a very scattered way but right. never really caught on. That's interesting
or
to know.
Or it's catching on, and at some point it may gain more common currency in basketball writing. And this is the main issue that Merriam-Webster is tackling now. We haven't even mentioned that. What Merriam-Webster is doing with its unabridged dictionary is revising the third edition of its Merriam-Webster's New International Dictionary. It was the last great unabridged dictionary that the company published in 1961. And upon its publication, it was the subject of tremendous public controversy because it was perceived as permissive and descriptive of the language rather than prescriptive. People were accustomed to having the dictionary tell you whether usage was right or wrong. The third took a much more permissive approach toward language and words, like ain't and irregardless. In other words, that sort of became cause célèbre in the 1960s. And it really was this gigantic cultural issue. The New York Times wrote a dozen editorials and op-eds about how bad this dictionary was. Dwight MacDonald wrote this mammoth piece in The New Yorker railing against Merriam-Webster for publishing this lax, permissive, sloppy dictionary. And it really wasn't any of those things. It was just different. It took a different approach to language. So now Merriam has finally decided after 50 years that they need to update this. And they decided to not print a new edition, a fourth edition of it, and to do this entirely online. And so the question, as you point out, is, well, if Upcycle has gained enough currency and we have found enough citations in newspapers and magazines and, you know, trade publications and business journals or whatever to merit its inclusion as a word, and upfake, yeah, it doesn't have as many, but hey, Bill Simmons used it in a column once, and the New York Times used it in a headline once, and a few sports writers have used it, so maybe we should just cite that and include it. So this is this real tug of war, because there's also a finite amount of time for lexicographers. I mean, they've got, there were 467,000 entries in Webster's third unabridged, and they want to revise all of these. And this creates a sort of a new sort of way of thinking about how a dictionary functions as well. Is it something that is finite, A to Z, and then you print it? Or is it now just this rolling change in language that we need to chronicle on a daily basis?
Right. And it is fundamentally a publishing story. I mean, these questions have been applied to news media and journalism more generally over the last two decades, right?
Sure.
Oh, you can just get the news in your pocket. You don't need to buy a physical item, newspaper or dictionary anymore. You can just tap it into your phone and search. But then also the fundamental economics of the industry remain, which is, yeah, you can search anything you want on your phone, but there needs to be an economic model to support there being stuff worth looking at the other end of those search queries. Otherwise, the utility of tapping into a search box falls away. You know, I think that it's so useful to have lexicographers putting these words in context and offering the sense of meaning. I mean, it's always fun to look up Urban Dictionary, and I understand that Wordnik and Urban Dictionary are two wildly different internet projects, but in terms of the kind of lexicographical authority that they mm-hmm. have and wield, but there is, yeah, I can type a word into Google's Ngram viewer and see how it's spiked up and down over time, but that's not the same as an informed expert putting it into context for me, and that is something that I value, and I'm excited that this company feels there is a digital future for itself. I mean, it seems in your piece as though the economics remain somewhat uncertain, but
they do, but less uncertain than I think that Merriam-Webster thought a decade or a decade and a half ago when they were still operating under the economic model of we got to keep printing. I mean, not that they were ever going to do a fourth. I mean, the last time that they seriously considered overhauling and putting this, 2,800-page dictionary into, you know, between leather covers. I mean, really, that idea died in the early to mid-1990s. And for the company, you know, the growth in advertising on its, they do have a free website, the dictionary, the Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary is what you would normally see online and go to. The Unabridged is a subscription-only website. And that model, you know, is up for debate, whether that's going to be the way to handle this. And they are generating enough ad revenue and enough sales from their backlist, because people are going to still buy dictionaries. You know, people are still going to buy paperbacks and learner's dictionaries and Spanish, you know, English dictionaries. I mean, there's all kinds of potential for physical products that's not gone away yet. But as John Morse, the president of Merriam-Webster, told me, we're a digital company now. We generate more revenue from digital products and subscriptions than we do from print sales. So their mindset has to be going forward, and this I think is where they haven't tapped into the potential yet, is how do we utilize the incredibly cool things that we can do, whether it's Google's Ngram viewer, whether it's analyzing corpuses more deeply to find words that we're missing, to gauge utility and usage in print media and spoken media. How do we do that better and present that to the reader so we're giving them more than just dictionary definition plus some examples of its use in quotations plus maybe an etymological note and a note on usage? Those things are considered innovative now. The ability to just write long, cool, sort of historical appreciations of words, which Merriam is doing. I cite a couple in the story. Bippy, as in You Bet Your Sweet Bippy, from the 1970 show Rowan and Martin's Laughing, to asshat, which is obviously pretty common parlance now. But so the ability to create these cool little biographies of words is one thing, but then how can they take it to the next step? How can they monetize and make it even cooler to look up words?
Stefan, there were a couple of things that struck me in your article, which is just so well reported and gives such a great on-site sense of what it's like inside that old schoolhouse building in Springfield, Massachusetts. One was just the sheer size of the English language lexicon. And I think you have a statistic in there that supposedly 52% of the English word hoard of over a million words is what's called lexical dark matter that's never been defined or explained anywhere. Could you talk about how that was arrived at and what that means for lexicography?
Sure. There was a project done that a lot of people have heard of called Culturomics, and it's a group of researchers at Harvard and MIT, and it's ongoing. They're still doing this. And this was back in 2010, they looked at Google's database, which at that point included 5.2 million digitized books and a total of like 360 billion distinct words in English, or distinct letter strings anyway, in English. They estimated that as of 2000, there were like more than a million unique words, and then they compared it to Merriam-Webster's Unabridged Dictionary and to the American Heritage Dictionary, which is also a big, fat, unabridged dictionary. And that's where they came up with this 52% figure, that these are words that we're missing. And some of those are going to be like words that are used once. Some are probably typos. But a lot of them are going to be usages that, you know, that gain some currency but never have risen to the threshold. I mean, there's the threshold that a lexicographer would say, hey, this is worthy of inclusion. And that might just be because lexicography, even in the digital age, is a fairly hit-or-miss process. I mean, the way that Merriam-Webster's definers have defined words and found them for, you know, 200 years since Noah Webster is to see them in print, take a snapshot of that usage, and then make this determination over time as they collected more evidence that it belonged. But you're going to miss a lot. So it's a lot less hit or miss than it was, because you can go to Nexus or to Google Books and type in a letter string and look for it. But what the Culturomics research shows is that, yeah, there's more to English than we're aware. The breadth is so much greater than any dictionary can possibly handle. So these resources can allow lexicographers to do a better job of finding these sort of mysterious words or these hidden words. And I think that's one area where lexicography is going to go, is how do we utilize these kinds of databases and the kinds of analytical tools that exist and we're getting used to in other realms like sports, and to make, to create better word portraits for the dictionary.
Well, that kind of leads me to my second question, which was just to whatever extent Google Ngrams and all of these scanned books and scanned archives have changed lexicography and the art of defining, there still is a lot of printed matter circulating at the Merriam-Webster office, it sounds like, right? There are shelves full of books and magazines and newspapers that the definers just sit around and read looking for new words or new usages of
totally.
Words.
Totally. And it's actually part of their daily jobs. They're instructed to spend an hour or two a day. It's called reading and marking. And they read whatever it is. It can be, you know, a catalog. It can be, you know, the L.L. Bean catalog. It can be a cereal box. It can be Slate. It can be newspapers, magazines, novels, anything. And when an editor sees an interesting usage of a word, and it's not just new words. When I was sort of skimming through the stacks of magazines and other printed matter there, I was finding things that I would look at and go, that's like a normal word. Like, that's in the dictionary, and why do we need to mark that? And a lot of it is searching for new senses of words, new usages of words, or just a really good quote to illustrate how a word is used. One definer, Emily Brewster, who I write about in the piece, and I didn't include this in the piece, but she found a new sense of the word A, which is sort of this magical moment for a lexicographer. Like, wow, I discovered something no one had seen before. That
it's like the Higgs boson.
Right. Exactly.
Wait, what was the sense? Can you explain it?
I can't explain. I can't remember now. I'd have to look through my notes.
But, I noticed she was...
Like, it was sort of like you look at it and you go, huh, okay, I get it. And a new sense meaning no one had written it down. It wasn't that we don't use it or someone hadn't, you know, used it in print. It's that no one had realized it and recorded it as a sense in a dictionary definition.
Can I ask you guys a totally like romantic nostalgia question? Do you guys still look up things in the print reference books and print dictionaries and other things, or have you shifted to digital?
I don't have a good enough online digital source. Now I kind of want to subscribe to this Merriam-Webster online unabridged because it's, what, $30 a year or something? Mm-hmm. It seems worth it because you get etymologies and all that stuff, right? Stefan, it's full
on. Yeah, you do, and you'll get more, but it's a slow process. You know, they've updated about 10,000 entries so far, and there's... You know, there are, like I said, 467 from the last printing of this, which was in 2002, the last update to the third. So gradually, but it's a very hit or miss process even there now. The subscription is great because you will stumble across, you know, these wonderful new words and new definitions. But at the same time, you get, if you happen on like a word, like some of the words I used in the story, these sort of famous definitions like oxygen and door, which are, and hotel, which are just absurd because they're long and they include all this detail, but it reflects the way we were thinking in, you know, 1961 about how words should be described. And there's this thoroughness and this authoritativeness to it that is really compellingly weird from a modern perspective, but also illustrative of how valuable the idea of explaining language is.
If I could answer the first part of Julia's question, I actually just gave my daughter a children's dictionary for Christmas and was showing her how to look up words in the dictionary and, you know, find things in alphabetical order. And when I really want to understand a word, the etymology and the history of it and the first usage and all that, I will actually haul out the old 2-volume OED and magnifying glass and read it. But that probably happens once every 6 months or so.
Or you could pay $295 a year and get the OED.
Yeah, I periodically dream of doing that, and then I look at the price and I cancel the plan.
Wow, $300 a year. No, I'm totally online. I just do a Google search and move on. But Stefan, there were many incredible parts to your article, but I loved when Perrault says, when we get to Z, we'll presumably continue right on to A again. So they're caught in an infinite lexicographical loop. But congratulations on the piece, and thanks so much for coming on the show.
It is my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
All right. The piece is called The Definition of a Dictionary. It's up on Slate now. Check it out and tell us what you think of it. All right. Well, now is the moment in our show where we endorse. Dana, what do you have?
All right, I'm going to endorse something that it's very possible that everyone who listens to our podcast already has heard this because it's a very popular podcast, but I'm one of those people who listens to Marc Maron only when he has a guest I care about. Sometimes when he has a comedy dude, it can just get too much double comedy dude for me. But he did the most wonderful interview with Paul Thomas Anderson last week, who was a great get for him. In 1 week, he got Richard Linklater and Paul Thomas Anderson to appear on his podcast. And I haven't heard the Linklater one yet, but the Paul Thomas Anderson interview is just just a cherry on top of the work of Maron's interviewing. It's wonderful. They get so comfortable together. They talk their way through all of Anderson's movies. You know, Maron is completely upfront about his reservations about certain movies, and Anderson finds all that really interesting, and they laugh a lot together. There's this really wonderful moment where they've got such a good dynamic going that Maron's going to go get a glass of water for Paul Thomas Anderson, and Anderson says, "Wait, stay with me, don't go." It's just this very, like, two guys in a dorm room in the best sense, and I learned a lot about Anderson's life and his filmmaking process, so I recommend the Marc Maron WTF interview with Paul Thomas Anderson.
All right, Julia, what do you have?
Actually, Steve, before I endorse, I just want to note that we have a correction from last week in our wide-ranging slash skeptical appreciation slash dismissal of Lee Daniels' new television show, Empire, which has gotten boffo ratings, by the way, and seems like it's here to stay. We mentioned some of Lee Daniels' past work, including Precious and The Butler, and we also credited him with Hustle and Flow, a film that starred Taraji P. Henson and Terrence Howard, but was not directed by Lee Daniels. We had that wrong. The director was Craig Brewer. It's one of those things where my spidey sense tingled when we said it, and we should have looked it up. So anyway, apologies to everyone, including Craig Brewer, Lee Daniels, and the full cast of Hustle and Flow, and all you listeners that we got that one wrong. All right, my endorsement is Serious Eats, which is a website that covers food generally, but the food scene in New York very extensively, and is run by a delightful obsessive named Ed Levine, who has recently published an opus about the New York City diner and the institution of the American diner generally. And he spent 3 months eating almost entirely in diners. And it's just great. It's just great to follow him down the diner path and hear those big, fat, round cornered plates clanking in your brain. So, yes, Ed Levine on Diners at Serious Eats. Mm. And actually, Steve, before you endorse, we have Joe in the studio to endorse. It is Joe Livingston's last day, our beloved intern. She's going to leave us to do a much more interesting things and complete her dissertation, which we're going to grill her about a little bit in our Slate Plus segment. But Joe, endorse.
I am going to endorse an unseasonal song that I've been listening to a lot lately. I'm going to endorse the Jonathan Richman song, That Summer Feeling. I don't know why, but I've just been listening to it walking around in the snow, thinking about summer, thinking about seasons and seasonal music. And I have a few reasons for it. It's about nostalgia. It's about thinking about your childhood and kind of the pain of remembering happy things, but also how you end up feeling nostalgic for things you didn't even like the first time around, like First Grade, which Jonathan Richman didn't even like, but now he remembers it so fondly. And I don't know, I feel like on my last day on the GabFest, I feel my memories of the studio around me already kind of fading into my happy nostalgia. it evokes something about that.
It's like the off-season summer strut, the winter strut.
Because yeah. It's a kind of lugubrious summer kind of, I don't know, it's not strutty at all. It's like lying face down on the grass, also works in the wintertime.
Very good. All right, Steve.
I'm going to endorse two completely, in the spirit of a pluralistic mind, I'm going to endorse two seemingly totally contrary things. The first is, having gone down the serial rabbit hole, I started reading Reddit, and I kind of love Reddit, and I love the idea.
Steven, if you become a Redditor, I don't know, all my worlds will collapse. It's awesome.
I
suis clearly, Reddit.
Clearly my internal world is collapsing. But anyway, so the Reddit is, I kind of love the idea of crowdsourced fact-checking and disputation. And I think we got to be alive to new technologies. Look, pamphleteering was once a major literary form in a way, and it disappeared and it's returned with the internet. I think we have to be open to how so-called disruption can produce new modes of knowing, and those new modes may be most appropriate to our new modes of living. On the other hand, I love the idea of the master thinker who's a total grump and who sees decline everywhere. And though I'm not really a fan of this person, I did enjoy reading Among the Disrupted by Leon Wieseltier in the New York Times, who seems to have found new life or is about to find new life after the demise of the New Republic as a contributor to The Atlantic. And it's just classic Leon. It's long, it's under-edited, it's grumpy, it's high-handed and completely ridiculous. But nonetheless, given the fatuousness with which Silicon Valley culture is taking over all of culture kind of necessary and heroic. Therefore, I endorse improbably both Reddit and Leon Wieseltier. All right. Thanks a lot, guys.
Love it.
Thanks, Dana.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Julia.
Thank you.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page, slate.com/culturefest, and you can email us at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note at our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Our producer is Ann Hepperman. Our interns are Josephine Livingston and Lindsay Albrecht. The managing producer of Slate Podcasts is Joel Meyer, and the executive producer of Slate Podcasts is Andy Bowers. For Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you soon.
That summer feeling, that summer feeling, summer feeling, when there's things to do, not because you gotta, when you run for love, not because you oughta, when you trust your friends with no reason nada, the joy I've named shall not be tamed, and that summer feeling is gonna haunt you one day in